Last week, Cuyahoga County settled a class action lawsuit over the conditions of the county jail brought by 19 former inmates. Lawyers for the inmates said this suit wasn't about money, but making changes at a jail that a U.S. Marshals report in 2008 deemed inhumane and deplorable. That same year, multiple inmates died within a matter of months. Today, we'll explore the lawsuit and hear about what the plaintiffs endured. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll speak with IdeaStream criminal justice reporter Matt Richmond and with the plaintiff's attorney about the changes in jail culture and operations they believe will be made as part of the settlement. Later in the show, a conversation with a young entrepreneur who started a drone company that's helping farmers in the region. Those conversations are coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Good morning, and thanks for joining us. On Tuesday of last week, Cuyahoga County reached a settlement with 19 plaintiffs involved in a class action lawsuit over conditions at the Cuyahoga County Jail. Back in 2018, a U.S. Marshals report found that conditions at the jail were inhumane, overcrowded, and deplorable. That same year, multiple inmates died within a matter of months. The U.S. Marshals report led to calls for reform and ultimately the class action lawsuit, which didn't have any monetary settlements for the plaintiffs, but instead focused on improvements to be made to the jail. We begin today's program with an update on the situation with the Cuyahoga County Jail. Then later in the program, we'll meet a young entrepreneur from Lorain County who's using drone technology for agricultural purposes in the region. But first, let's talk about the jail with IdeaStream Public Media's criminal justice reporter, Matt Richmond. Matt, great to see you.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. And joining us by phone, we have Sarah Gelsomino. She's a civil rights attorney and one of the lawyers involved in the class action suit. Sarah, thanks for making time this morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
And if you'd like to join the conversation or have a question for our guests, you can call toll-free 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Matt, let's go back to 2018. Can you give us an overview of what the U.S. Marshals report said and how that ultimately led to this lawsuit?
Yeah, and you know, I can still remember the day when that report was released because it was so blunt and it was so kind of jaw-dropping about how bad the things were in there. And it was written, you know, by the U.S. Marshal for Cleveland, not somebody who is, you wouldn't expect to be so blunt about the failures in the jail. And, you know, he just did not hold back. And I think the report focused on how the building was not able to take in the number of people that were being brought there. At that point, they had expanded the population of the jail. And so, you know, there were people who were being held in parts of the building that, you know, had no business holding people. There were people who were coming there who needed medical attention and they were not receiving it. I mean, there were just some shocking instances of people just laying on the floor.
Pregnant women.
And pregnant women were forced to sleep on the floor in some instances. And so then it also talked about how the building itself was just getting too old and was, you know, had plumbing issues, was not a humane place to hold people. And then there were also issues with staffing. You know, there weren't enough staff to kind of properly monitor all the people that were being held there. So they were holding people in their cells for exorbitant periods of time just because there was only one person who was overseeing, you know, 100 prisoners. And then finally, there were some big issues with the way that uses of force were being monitored and reported and handled that were really painted a very frightening picture about what it was like to be in the jail.
What does that mean, frightening?
That, you know, there was a real fear of, there was particularly a group, they're known as the Men in Black, who would come into the population and would do things like, you know, if there was a cell that a guard needed to go into, they were kind of there to provide extra security.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when in the Marshall's report, they talked about speaking to some prisoners about that group particularly and them receiving threats and being afraid to talk about how this group kind of handled their work.
So then, Sarah, the genesis of the suit, of which you are an attorney representing plaintiffs, tell us about that and then ultimately who you were representing.
Sure. So back in 2018, when all this information started coming out about the jail, or I guess it just came to a head with the Marshall's report, and so many people were dying, and we were receiving so many phone calls from people who were being housed at the jail and their family members crying out for help. And we kept waiting for someone to do something about it and finally realized that we would have to be the ones to step up and do something. So we, along with other civil rights lawyers in town, spent so much time interviewing people in the jail, trying to figure out what was going on there and whether we could substantiate what the marshals found also. And we put together a group of 19 people who were being housed at the jail at the time to be class representatives on behalf of every single person in the jail. And that's what is kind of unique about this case, is that the way it was structured as just a lawsuit for changes in the jail, right? As you said, there was no monetary relief for any plaintiffs. It was simply to try to get relief in terms of the conditions of the jail. So these 19 people represent each of the deficiencies in the jail. Each of them had, you know, among them, they could each speak to every single part of the constitutional deficiencies that we named in the lawsuit. And they were really brave to step up and do that. It was, like Matt said, a very scary time in the jail. I think, you know, in a lot of ways it still is, but they were very afraid of retaliation. And they were really brave to step up and do it. And so these 19 people have represented everyone who is currently housed at the jail since that time, including up until now. And hopefully what we were able to achieve here in this lawsuit will make some shifts for the better inside the jail.
So Sarah, lead plaintiff is Tanya Clay, and she represented a certain aspect of kind of the grievous nature of this jail, which both now you and Matt have deemed scary, and I don't take that term lightly when anyone in that field is describing a jail. Can you tell me what Tanya went through and then kind of tell me what other things were going on that made this both inhumane and deplorable?
Sure. Tanya is wonderful and was in the jail for, and like so many people, really charges that were not very serious. And, you know, if we look at this holistically, we have to question why so many people are being held in the jail to begin with. You know, Tanya definitely could have been safely and responsibly on bond conditions that did not require her to be confined
in the first place.
Jail. Right. But, you know, Tanya had mental health issues and addiction issues that needed resources and housing that was different than what she was provided. She also had access. I mean, she also will speak very, and has actually, Matt heard her last week, speak very strongly about just some of the regular conditions in terms of access to hygiene materials, the food conditions, and the access to mental and medical health care. And that was really a huge part of what we were seeing, is that people were not being housed appropriately. Disciplinary segregation was being used when people needed just other safe, restricted housing. People were not getting access to medical and mental health care and not being screened appropriately when they came into the jail. We had the honor of representing the family of Greg Fox, who committed suicide in the jail because he never got access to mental health care. It was so actively suicidal that other inmates had to be the ones to try to support him while he was expressing suicidal ideations. And unfortunately, he never received any services and he killed himself there. It was completely unnecessary. And really, in his honor, we spent a lot of time looking at all of those suicide policies and mental health care policies to try to make sure that there were some safeguards But, you know, ultimately, like Matt said, they're just housing too many people in the facility, and there are not enough staff to do it safely. And that is what our joint expert in the course of this lawsuit came out and said very strongly. There are not enough staff. They are not trained appropriately. And the culture is not set up and supervised in a way to make people safe while they're in the jail. And that's a real problem. And hopefully some of the policies and changes and training that will come out of this lawsuit will make a difference there. But the county really has to do a lot of soul searching about how and why people are being housed there, and commit themselves to their safety. And I will say the county, throughout this settlement process and investigation process, has shown an interest in that. Brendan Healy, particularly from the county law department, has done so much work to try to move this jail into constitutional compliance. So I'm hopeful that there will be some good changes that result.
Matt, we don't have the details of the settlement. That's what my understanding is. Is that right? But we do know kind of what has been stipulated and wanted by the plaintiffs. Can you tell me some areas where we might see reform?
Yeah, and I mean, I think Sarah could probably talk about this a little bit. We saw the report that was created by the expert that the county and the plaintiffs agreed to. And that has a long series of our recommendations. And I'm not sure what exactly are kind of the changes that are going to be overseen by the court going forward now that there's an agreement. But what you saw in that report was that, you know, well, so first of all, that the county staff need to do a better job of investigating uses of force. They need to make sure that when people arrive at the jail, they're getting medical screening before they're brought to wherever they're going in the population. And, you know, there was some concerns raised about the way, you know, there are people who are segregated from the general population for a few different reasons, some of it because of, like, behavioral, because they're not safe for other prisoners. But some people because they need to be protected or mm-hmm. for just other reasons. And they were all kind of grouped together, and it was kind of generally used as punishment for everyone who was in the segregation area. Mm. So there are things like that. There are ongoing complaints about the quality of the food in the jail. And, you know, it's not it's not clear what can be done about that, but there is a separate monitor over the food contract. Like the county recently renewed the contract with that food provider, but there will be some oversight now about how food is prepared and provided to prisoners.
And Sarah, will you add to that? And specifically, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the need for, you know, you've talked about not enough staff. So what are some of the guidelines or requests that you all are making that you think will come out of this settlement ultimately in improving the jail conditions?
Sure. And the actual settlement agreement will be made public shortly, but okay. I can speak to it. We went through a long process with the county of rewriting a lot of policies so that all of the recommendations of the joint expert were written into the policies. And the county has agreed to both implement those policies and train on those policies. In terms of staffing, and you know, those policies include like the use of force policy so that there are some shifts in the requirements for that the men in black, as Tanya calls them, for that special team that goes in to use force for like cell extractions and when and other situations like that. The restraint chair policy, which we saw was the real misuse of the restraint chair as a transport and in a very punitive way, which is not appropriate. So that's been rewritten and will be retrained on. The mental health and mental and medical care access. Transparency is a big deal because, like Matt said, the reports, you know, when our expert went in to review the jail, they ran into problems because there weren't even reports being generated so that they could look to see what was happening.
Wow.
So that may seem, you know, kind of a like an uninteresting point of the settlement, but it's actually really important because if things aren't being documented, then we can't be, you know, investigating them, right, and reviewing them. And what are supervisors doing if they're not even, if their underlings aren't even writing down what's happening in the jail? So that will, all of that will be accessible now, hopefully, so that people like Matt can, you know, follow what's happening in the jail and really get a truer picture of it. The contract monitors are also a part of the lawsuit that I think is really important. You know, the food continues to be a problem. And when you are housed in a facility like this jail for months and even years without a breath of fresh air and without being able to move, food is really, really important.
Sure.
And it's horrific there. It is still horrific there. The county did renew the contract with Trinity. There are problems with that contract. I mean, we are still getting reports nearly daily about the conditions of the food at the jail with bugs, moldy food, just, I mean, disgusting, inhumane food, which then steamrolls into all other kinds of problems in the jail.
Sure.
The so, you know, they're under contract now, but hopefully with the contract monitor to really be examining whether Trinity's even falling into contract and to push for some better contracts in the future. Our experts spent a lot of time on this. I mean, something as simple as food warmers, which exists in the corrections world, right? So that warm food can be served to people,
right.
Appropriate portions of food can be served to people. You know, simple things like that, I hope the contract monitor is able to stay on top of so that the conditions can be moderately better for people. Also, in terms of ongoing monitoring, the county has agreed to hire an expert, a corrections expert, to monitor the compliance with the settlement agreement. So every 6 months, that person will do an in-person inspection of the jail and make a public reporting about whether the jail is where the jail is at in terms of coming into compliance with the settlement agreement. So there will be some external reporting again, and you know the jail can't just operate in secret.
Sarah, we have a minute left, but I want to ask you, did you look to other federal jails or prisons? Jeff from North Royalton was wondering, is there a gold standard when it comes to places of incarceration?
Is there a gold standard? Oh, that's a tough one for me. But we did look at other jails and other lawsuits like this. One of the lawyers who actually came on to help us has a lot of experience in that nationally. We looked at other settlements that had come out of other jails in California, among other places, to get some guidance as to how to make some meaningful change here.
Sure. Well, I know that there's a lot to watch over in the next 180 days the county has to initiate these new policies. Matt, I know you'll be monitoring. Sarah, we'd love to check back in with you and see ultimately how the plaintiffs and plaintiff's attorney are responding to the changes that are being made. So Matt, how will you kind of keep your eye on all of this?
Well, like Sarah said, the having these public reports makes such a huge difference. And, you know, I've seen some of the policy changes and they talk about some of the policy changes publicly, but there's no other way to really get a good idea about whether or not those policies are being followed and whether or not it's actually making a difference. One of the issues before the Marshall's report came out is that the yearly state inspections of the jail were not picking up any of this. And so you can't really rely on those. And so this is going to be the best opportunity that we've ever had to have sort of an ongoing status updates of the conditions in there.
And Sarah, quick answer. I mean, are the plaintiffs vindicated? How is Tanya feeling to know that this suit is being settled and essentially, you know, that cry out for help has been heard?
You know, honestly, it's a mixed bag for her and others because they feel very proud that they were able to do something. But it's hard to be hopeful when you experienced those kinds of conditions yourself and felt the kind of disinterest from the guards when you were in there to believe that it's actually going to make a change. But Tanya's hopeful.
Attorney Sarah Gelsomino, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And our own Matt Richmond, thanks so much for sharing your reporting.
Happy to be here.
We have to pause now for a break. On the other side, I'm going to speak with a young entrepreneur in Lorain who is using drone technology he developed to help our farmers. You're with the Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for staying with us. This year, we've been focusing on some area creators, inventors, and entrepreneurs as part of a series called Maker Mondays. Today, we meet a young man from Lorain County whose love and curiosity for technology, along with living in a rural area, have combined into a unique new venture. Ethan Moore is a 22-year-old who grew up in Wellington, Ohio, and is now the founder of Lake Erie Drone. He's on a mission to assist the region's agricultural community by making the application of pesticides and other treatments more effective, efficient, and safe. I sat down with Ethan recently to talk about his new endeavor. Ethan, I know you got interested in drone technology in high school when you had to use one for a class. So tell me about that experience and how that kind of ignited your general interest in drones.
Yeah, so this was actually a pretty cool story. Back when I was in high school, I took an AV class, and one of the things that we did in that class was we created a weekly news segment to capture just the things that were going on at our high school. This was Wellington High School. At the time, I was like watching these videos online about drones and new drone technology, and there wasn't really a commercial aspect to it yet. There wasn't a whole lot of, you know, ready kits ready to go.
Sure.
So we found a building plan to construct a drone from parts, including the batteries. And we got all these like flight controllers and electronic speed controllers that we had to solder on. And I pitched the idea to our high school teacher. And I was like, wouldn't this be cool if we could build this drone to film like our football games or, you know, just to put it in our segments? And he was like, that would be very cool. So we got some funding and we ordered all the parts and we started building this drone. And over the course of a year, me and a couple other classmates, we learned how to solder wire.
Wow.
How to, you know, build this creation, which we now lovingly refer to as Franken-drone, because it definitely looks like a handmade creation.
And was there, again, instructions online that you were following, or was this just kind of
It was kind of like a mishmash of YouTube videos, translated user manuals, and a little bit of experimentation, to put it lightly.
Wow, that's really impressive. And it still works today.
It still works today, yes.
That's awesome. So drones, as we know now, used in a lot of different disciplines, delivery services, probably a lot more in the future, to security, recreation. So how did you land on an agricultural application for your drone?
Absolutely. So this setup, this first exposure was in high school. So after that, I went to, I did early college or college credit plus, and I focused on nursing. Got my degree in nursing. I started practicing in ICU. And then after about a year, it started to get kind of settling into my new role. And I just had this like inkling in the back of my mind. I was like, I wonder what's going on in that drone space, because I saw it as such a rudimentary phase.
Right.
I wonder what's going on there. So I did some research and I thought, oh my gosh, the new drones are like so small and they're nice. They're beautiful cameras. They fly so easily. So I purchased a new Mini 3 Pro at the time. And I was like, well, this is awesome. And I started to look into, I go, well, if the consumer side is so sophisticated now, I wonder if a lot of the things that we thought about back then as being theoretical things in the future.
That drones can be used for.
Exactly. I wonder if those are starting to come to fruition. So I started to look into it. And I saw that they were using drones to spray chemicals. And I thought, well, that's kind of cool because my parents are beekeepers. We have a honey farm.
Wow.
And so the pesticide exposure and how it's affected the bees was always something that we always talked about. And was and how we would lose hives because of drift onto the beehives that were on the periphery of the fields. So the dangers of pesticide were always something that I was also exposed to when I was growing up. So I started reading about using drones for pesticide application, and we live in a very agricultural community in Wellington, surrounded by farm fields. And there were many times growing up, I remember the crop dusting plane flying over our house.
Sure.
Because we have a field right next door. When they said that you could use this to spray crops, I was like, well, this is really a cool application. And it's something that a service that I could bring to my community that I grew up in.
Wow.
Rather than, you know, you could get like a movie cinema drone, but in our community of Wellington, we're agriculture. I thought I could bring that technology to the people that I know and the people in my community and provide, hopefully, a better service than traditional methods.
So I've seen a picture of the drone that we are talking about, but kind of describe to our listener what this drone is equipped with to make it ready to, let's say, spray pesticides on a field.
Sure. And it's hard to fully grasp the size of it unless you can see a picture or see it in person. I guarantee it's bigger than what you're imagining. And it's like a monster. It's got it's got four propellers on four axles, one on top, one on bottom. And it roars when it takes off. And the idea is that it has to take off with 10 gallons of liquid, or I can swap it out for a seeder tank, and I can apply like granular fertilizers or seeds. And then, even still, the maximum takeoff capacity of the payload is 120 pounds, and the maximum takeoff capacity of the whole aircraft is 220 pounds. So if you can imagine the size it requires to generate the amount of lift, it's a monster. It's kind of like a Fiat size.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty big. And it can just, I haven't never tried it. I would never recommend it, but I think it could lift me just looking at the specs.
And so when you see it flying over, let's say, some farmland or a field, is it going high, low?
Well, that's what's really cool about it and why this is a lot better than crop dusters. Because it is based on a quadcopter design, it can hover, whereas a fixed-wing aircraft can never hover. It has to be in constant motion. So as a result, one of the things is that we can get right above the crop canopy. 10 feet off of corn is, typically
so
where
close.
We're at. It's so close. And the downdraft of the propellers disrupt the canopy. A lot of what we treat in corn is for fungus. Mm-hmm. And where does fungus grow? In dark, damp places. Not the top leaves. It's the dark bottom leaves that, have the dew on them for a long period of time, doesn't get the sun exposure. Mm. That's where the pesticide is really effective. And so having that downdraft, flying so low, gets right into the canopy. And it doesn't drift off target. It doesn't go off the field. It doesn't go onto people's houses. It doesn't go into the beehives. So it's a better product overall.
So you've leveraged this drone that can put on pesticides, even seeds, onto farmland or fields into a company called Lake Erie Drone. Do you have clients who's using your services?
Yes. So I started. So my first exposure to this drone was I went out to a conference in Vegas and I just wanted to learn more about it. So I saw the drone itself. I talked to some people who were using it in the United States at the time, and they were like, I was a little, cautious. I didn't think that, I wasn't sure. I wasn't completely sold. Talked to them. They loved it and they had seen a lot of success and it helped their crops improve quite a bit. So I started to get sold on it. So this was in November of 22. I incorporated Lake Erie Drone. I purchased the drone and the generator and everything that went into it, which was quite a large undertaking, a leap of faith for sure.
Sure.
And after that, we were in standstill for a while. And the reason for that is because to fly a drone that's over 55 pounds and one that carries hazardous chemicals, understandably, there's a large regulatory process involved. Mm-hmm. And it involves two agencies largely, which is the EPA. I'm now a registered pesticide applicator, and I own a registered pesticide business, which I, if you asked me 5 years ago, I did not think I'd be going down this path. And then I have to register a lot through the FAA. So I have to get my drone pilot license as step one. I had that, fortunately. After that, I had to get a medical certificate. I had to be inspected by a medical examiner to make sure that I wasn't liable to pass out while I'm flying, just like any commercial pilot, which was kind of interesting. And then I had to register the drone itself. Because the drone's over 55 pounds, in the eyes of the FAA, it's more airplane than it is drone. Mm-hmm. So I have to register it as kind of like an airplane. It gets an N number instead of a drone registration number.
Interesting.
An N number, just like any other airplane or helicopter. I have to register it as a a part 137 is a permission to dispense hazardous chemicals from an aircraft, a process I had to go through. I had to go through a process called part 44807, where I had to petition all these rules that exist for drone use. And I had to say, I need exemptions from these. One of the rules of flying an aircraft that dispenses hazardous chemicals is you must have a seatbelt on the aircraft at all times.
Wow.
So I had to request an exemption from that rule. And then
Because
no one's in it. I had to explain why. I had to make my operation fit into the current legal system pertaining to agricultural airplanes, basically. So that was, as you can imagine, that was a lengthy process of submitting documents to the FAA, getting some feedback, revising and resubmitting. And so that took quite a while.
Right.
If you remember, I purchased the drone in 22. Fortunately, in terms of FAA speak, we actually got our approvals rapidly.
Okay.
And that would be July of 23. So it was actually not too bad.
So not too long ago, though,
not
that you became fully regulated and ready for air.
Yes.
And so now do you have clients?
And so now we have done a lot of projects.
Oh, wow.
It's been really cool. I did about 1,200 acres this year alone. And it was our first year. We had a lot of, like, you know, just operational lessons that we learned. And I didn't feel like I could really start marketing my product until I got those certifications, because I had no idea when I would finally get those. So starting in July, really was starting in August, we hit the ground running, and we got tons of corn. We sprayed on soybean. We sprayed on blueberries. Wasn't expecting that. There's an organic bacteria that you can apply to blueberries that helps reduce the beetle population that eats the blueberries. The only thing is that when it rains, it washes off this, it's called BT, Bacillus thuringiensis. And when it rains, it washes it off, so you have to reapply it. And the way they had to do it before was they had to take all these nets off. It took like a whole day to spray it on, and then when it rains, it's gone again. We found we could take the drone and fly it over the nets and spray it on once weekly, and it eliminated the, or really cut down the beetle population and improved the yields of this blueberry farm.
So you are effectively improving the situation for some of our local farmers with your drone.
Absolutely. And it's just about adding capabilities and providing a high quality product. Because even up until then, I wasn't 100% sold. I had flown some test flights, spraying some water in my backyard, but I wasn't entirely convinced. Once we started doing it, once I started spraying corn that had fungus starting, and I applied our antifungal, you know, treatments, I could see that that totally arrested or stopped the development of the fungus in those fields. That is such a cool feeling to know that not only—
It's actually working.
It's actually working. To see it proven in front of you, that was cool.
Well, Ethan, I'm thoroughly impressed by you. I want to know if you have any thoughts on growing the business. Is it going to go beyond the one drone? Are you actually working as a nurse now, and where do you have all the time to do all this? So first, let's talk about the future of Lake Erie Drone. Are you going to keep it to one drone? Are you talking to other farmers about expanding?
Well, what's really cool about drone, and this is really what motivates me to expand in the drone space and my background in healthcare, is I work in our ICU. I've been doing it for almost 3 years now, it'll be 3 years in July. And every once in a while, we, you know, have a patient with a huge lung cancer.
Mm.
And it's, you know, they're end stage, and it's like, oh, man, this is just awful. How did this happen? And then you come to find out, then the family comes in and go, oh, grandpa farmed his whole life. And then when you hear that, you're like, oh, now it makes sense. That's, you know, why, you know, all these people are developing lymphomas and lung cancers, because of the ingestion of chemicals.
Wow.
So for me, what my personal mission statement when it comes to the adoption of drone technology is how do you use tools to remove people from danger by not having a person in the cab of a crop duster? And that is, flying itself is incredibly dangerous. And, you know, they pass away, unfortunately, very frequently. Helicopter and airplane crop dusters die all the time. Terrible shame. And the other application is the exposure to the chemicals that they're dispensing is going to affect them, the community that they're doing it in. So if we can remove, and then the other conventional way of applying pesticides is through a ground rig, spraying it. And it affects, you know, now we have pressurized cabs, fortunately, but, you know, people around as well, not only, but it still affects those people who are piloting the ground rigs. So my goal with drones is trying to find ways that people are endangering themselves to get things done. Infrastructure inspections. Imagine trying to do an inspection of a bridge on a busy roadway. How can we use tools to make that a safer process? How can we be able to inspect things? Like not too long ago, we had that bridge in Pennsylvania that had issues. They had to close down a roadway. The fact that the bridge itself had a failure on the scale that it did could have been correlated to inadequate or insufficient inspections. Radio towers is another one. Power lines is another one. These assets need to be inspected because if they fail, then it puts people's lives at risk. Not only that, but it also endangers the people who are doing the work itself. So how can we use tools to reduce that risk? And I think that's what's really exciting to me broadly. So Lake Erie Drone is focused on the agricultural sphere. We will continue to expand our drone fleet and our mission capabilities as long as a business is able to support it. And a lot of the farmers that we've worked with so far are people who are early adopters of technology. As we continue to see more people seeing the validity of this technique and we get more research. There's some excellent research coming out of, I think, Alabama State University, who are just focused on researching the efficacy of the drones versus conventional means. And it's looking better and better as time goes on. So I expect more and more adoption. And there's no shortage of farm fields in Northeast Ohio.
Ethan Moore, founder of Lake Erie Drone, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
If you want to get a last word on our earlier topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter now, X. It's Sound of Ideas. You can follow me at @JennyHamill_. You can follow me also on Instagram at @JennyHamillIdeastream. Tomorrow on the Sound of Ideas, it's primary day, so we're going to check in with our news team and see what they'll be covering, plus a conversation with Cleveland City Council President Blaine Griffin. If you missed any portion of the program, find us online or listen to The Sound of Ideas. You can also hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 p.m. on 89.7 WKSU. Once again, I'm Jenny Hamill. I'll speak with you again tomorrow.